Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that discourages both dog whistling and wolf whistling. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Now, we're going to talk about a divided party, possibly troubled by institutionalised racism, with a leadership unwilling to condemn inappropriate remarks. You can fill in your own punchline there, obviously, listeners. But what we are going to talk about is the Boris Johnson remarks over the burqa, which is also being used a bit as a proxy war for the Remain and Leavers in the Conservative Party to spend the summer just tearing bits out of each other. But those remarks, we're going to talk about them at the end because they're part of a more interesting story about the possible rise of the far right in the UK. And that's the subject of this week's podcast. Banned in France earlier this year, but obviously Boris Johnson proves that dog whistling is on the rise in Great Britain. We're going to start, though, with a party where racism is not so much of a dog whistle, Steve, it's more of a klaxon at the moment, and that's the UK Independence Party.
Ah, UKIP. They're no longer the force they once were. The Tories aren't necessarily concerned with them peeling off their voters in the way that they once threatened to do. They don't have any chance of winning any MPs. And yet somehow they're still there and they're still kind of finding themselves relevant due to the absolute ridiculousness that is British politics.
Maybe a bit like the vegetable in the fridge that you ignore because it's terrible and then grows mouldy and takes over the entire fridge.
Which seems to be a pretty apt description of UKIP, actually. They were effectively discarded after the Brexit referendum and the Conservatives full-throatedly endorsed the concept of Brexit and leaving. And since then, their support plunged and dropped out. UKIP received something like 4 million votes in the 2015 election, and yet recently they've been polling, in some polls, a whopping 0%, represented by an asterisk in the pollster's findings. I think that was Servation.
Yeah, so that was Servation in July. Yeah. Not even political geniuses like noted Nobel Prize winner and Liverpool footballer Paul Nuttall could seemingly drag UKIP out of the electoral hole it had dug itself into. And what seemed to turn UKIP round is the reaction to the Chequers speech. And we talked a little bit about that a couple of weeks ago. But in June, before all the Chequers compromises and agreements that Theresa May got through, UKIP were polling somewhere between 3 and 4% in the polls. Now, a small but significant increase. So we're looking at, say, 5, 6, 7, sometimes even 8 and 9% in the polls.
Yeah, still not quite hitting double digits, but a definite improvement on their position before. Now, a lot of this has been written up to a negative reaction to Theresa May's Chequers deal. And there's probably some truth to that. It's no secret that an awful lot of the Brexiteers in the Conservative Party, and therefore you can assume amongst the Conservative Party grassroots as well, and Conservative Party voters, are not particularly happy with the Chequers deal, viewing it as some form of surrender to the EU. If that's unpopular in the Conservative Party, it stands to reason that people might make the jump from the Conservatives to UKIP in terms of how they are voting, if for nothing else then as a way to register a protest against the direction that the government is going on the issue of the day.
And that's the thing with UKIP's polling, isn't it? And actually, and we're not going to talk about the Lib Dems in this one, sorry Mark, but actually the Lib Dems have started also to reach double digits in polls fairly regularly as well in this July. We don't know if that's quite a reaction to the fact that the Lib Dems seem very anti-Brexit and it's a protest reaction to that, and that that UKIP's very pro-Brexit and it's reaction to that. If it's a wider symptom of votes, or if it's just a sort of mid-term blues and a bit of a protest. You know, you tell a pollster, but actually in your constituency, you might sympathise with, say, UKIP, but vote for the Tory candidate.
And this is very much a problem for UKIP if they want to try and turn this increased vote share from the polls into something meaningful in the future, because at the moment, their infrastructure was gutted after they basically collapsed. Many, many of their members left. There are councils which they used to control, which they're now no longer even able to put up a full slate of candidates in, which is a massive indictment on their infrastructure as it stands these days. Which means even if there are people who might be inclined to vote UKIP, they're not necessarily going to have a candidate come the next election.
And they have apparently since Chequers, there's a Matthew Goodwin article that was in The Spectator, which is interesting, worth checking out, saying that they've got 2,500 new members. And the impression one gets is that they are more of what you might call the alt-right than a lot of the UKIP members were under Farage. There's a very, very weird, maybe is the best way of putting it, video that Neil Hamilton recorded on Twitter a few months ago, in which he was in front of a map of Britain holding a glass of wine. And it looked a bit like, for those fans of 90s celebrity chef TV shows, if you imagine Keith Floyd leading a military junta, that's kind of the vibe that you got, this kind of dodgy old man with a glass of wine. But what he was recording the video about was the joining up to UKIP of quite famous figures on the alt-right. So if you're on Twitter, you might have come across people like Prison Planet, I think is PJ Watson, I think.
Yeah.
And Count Dankula as well, who are quite active figures in the alt-right Twitter sphere. And they've joined UKIP. And I think that's quite significant. The other thing that's quite significant is Gerard Batten, who UKIP leader is the absolute spitting image of the actor in Hot Fuzz, the awful Amdram actor in Hot Fuzz who is killed in a car crash.
Oh God, I hadn't even twigged that.
Absolute spitting image. So Amdram actor Gerard Batten, he's come out and he's talking about how he compares Islam to a death cult and all this kind of thing. And I think this is quite significant with UKIP because when Farage was leader, he was always very, very clear at distinguishing, say, UKIP from the BNP. And UKIP never really indulged with a sort of far-right neo-Nazi fringe of British politics. Farage, quite different now in his kind of iteration as kind of talking head. He's praising Marine Le Pen in a way that he wouldn't do a few years ago. But UKIP under Gerard Batten's leadership definitely trying to get these alt-right figures. And that's becoming their USP now, much more radically right-wing than they were seen under Farage.
It's quite an interesting shift because we've gone from under Farage, absolutely, UKIP, whilst that element was almost certainly there, there was at least an attempt at more respectability, for lack of a better call. It was old brigadier racism rather than white nationalism. You know, it's just doddery old fools who don't know any better, rather than let's send everybody back to where they came from. And indeed, one of the many leadership elections that UKIP have had over the past couple of years.
Have there been more UKIP leadership elections or new centrist parties?
That is a good pub quiz question. But in one of those leadership elections, the one where Henry Bolton, former leader, who you may remember from his brief tenure, ended up disgracefully leaving after basically having an affair or something with somebody who was racist and lied about it.
He was more interested in sleeping with a racist than leading UKIP.
In the election that he won, there was a candidate in that election by the name of Anne-Marie Waters, who was effectively like the alt-right candidate. She was very much trying to position UKIP as in a way that's probably very similar to what Jared Batten's doing now, anti-Islam as a kind of a core message. Much more stringently right-wing and nationalistic. And the UKIP voters rejected that in favour of the more traditional Henry Bolton. Obviously, that didn't end well, but they did reject this once. And yet now they have shifted into a full acceptance as a party of that sort of politics by bringing in the likes of PJ Watson, a.k.a. Prison Planet, is involved with Alex Jones's InfoWars, you know, that conspiratorial nonsense media, quote-unquote, company, which has recently found itself basically banned from every social media platform other than Twitter, because Twitter are awful and refuse to actually take any action. PJ Watson is kind of very much from that Breitbart-esque, alt-right, kind of US-style culture war way of doing things.
Mm.
You know, those sorts of figures are becoming mainstream within UKIP and are being welcomed by Batten and welcomed by their notable figures such as Neil Hamilton, which all presents a very interesting shift and an interesting dynamic away from where they were before.
And I think what's interesting is one of the reasons why Bolton won the UKIP leadership election and Anne-Marie Waters didn't, I think, is because Farage did swing behind Bolton in that election and did say, well, if Waters wins, I'm going to set up a new party. He'll do another comeback into British politics. It'll be interesting to see how Farage reacts to this new grouping. But the rise of UKIP and its solidification into a more extreme far-right party comes as some quite disturbing polling comes up about the degree to which actually large numbers of Britons might feel comfortable in voting for far-right ideas. And there's a couple of things. One of them is a poll which says that a quarter of Britons would be prepared to vote for an explicitly far-right, anti-immigration, pro-Brexit, anti-Islamist party, which is a kind of thing that you always need to take with a little pinch of salt. And again, as you say, it depends on which candidates are in constituencies. And under the first-past-the-post system, often it becomes people trying to keep out the people you don't like rather than vote for things you would be interested in. But the fact there's quite a large constituency out there, I think, is significant.
Yeah, just as an example of how much of a pinch of salt you need to use when you're talking about that kind of polling, a similar poll was released in the past couple of days asking a similar kind of question about the Liberal Democrats, where it found something like 75% of people were open, quote-unquote, to voting Lib Dem. And yet, they're still only polling roughly just getting into the double digits. Being open does not translate into anything meaningful necessarily.
Well, indeed. I remember similar polls coming out about the Lib Dems during the Kennedy years about how 48% of people said that they would vote for the Lib Dems if they thought that had a chance of winning the country. And I'm pretty sure that similar polls have also been done with BNP policies. Yeah. So these things happen, but it's something to take note of, I think.
Yeah.
And more interesting take on that kind of view was a YouGov survey that they did, which was trying to look at the views in British politics where most ordinary Britons feel the most unrepresented in terms of where is the gap in the market for a new party, centrist or otherwise. The biggest political belief that stands out above the rest that is held by quite a lot of people is that the justice system isn't harsh enough. So 2/3 of Britons hold that view. And 38% believe that none of the main parties share their view. In terms of actually things like justice isn't harsh enough and immigration restrictions should be lighter, they are issues that most people feel aren't represented in the politics and are believed by a lot of people. And so there's polling that actually, in terms of the gap in the market, it's not really for a pro-EU, socially liberal centre party. That's the Lib Dems. Or maybe the right of the Labour Party. In fact, the place that's actually unrepresented is that far-right grouping, almost a kind of right-wing authoritarian, but quite left-wing economically.
Yeah, and it should be said that this isn't necessarily a new development. Various bits of polling like this have been done over the years, and I can remember that there was some polling done, I think it must have been during the coalition years. Similar findings were found. When you dig into it, actually, what the biggest gap in the market for is for a fascist party in some description. Now, I'm almost certain, due to the way that British politics and British culture is, if you were to go around and actively say, hi, we're the fascists, vote for us, you wouldn't get very far. But if you were to be play it cannily and do it properly, you could easily get somewhere with a party that in its ideology was fascist.
Maybe a fascist anti-Brexit party could be a big tent and cover all bases.
I think my brain just leaked out my ears.
The far right in Britain also has at the moment is they have a cause célèbre. So they have the cause célèbre of Tommy Robinson, also known as Stephen Yaxley Lennon.
Tommy Robinson, as I'm sure most of our listeners will be aware, former founder, I believe, of the English Defence League, or
so.
EDL. General Yob, hooligan, multiple convictions for fraud, domestic abuse.
I think hitting a policeman.
Yeah,
that, one
so that was his first one, I believe. Mm. Basically just an all-round awful human being.
Yes.
He was out on a suspended sentence, broke the conditions of his suspended sentence, and got sent to jail, as happens when you do these things.
Mm, it's contempt of court, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, and as a result, since he was released, has become a very fashionable individual not just in the UK, but in the US as well, where he's been doing the rounds on right-wing talk shows.
And he was on Tucker Carlson, wasn't he, on Fox News?
Yeah, spewing all kinds of lies about how he was treated in prison, just declaring that he was put in solitary confinement when, in actuality, the prison that he was in doesn't have solitary confinement as a thing. Saying, basically, the worst thing that actually happened to him was he couldn't watch TV for a bit.
I'm shocked that Fox News allowed people on to say such untrue things.
I mean,
it's gone downhill since Dan Hanan was going on about how bad the NHS was.
It's true.
Oh, wait.
It's very true.
Never mind.
But yeah, Robinson, because of the way that his followers have been pushing this on social media, has become almost a martyr for the cause and given them something to focus on and talk about, with to the extent where figures like Steve Bannon, when he was doing an interview with LBC and a recorded rant which happened after the interview had actually finished, described Robinson as the backbone of the nation. So he's a vile individual, but he has become increasingly more prominent, and I'm expecting him to continue that prominence for quite some time.
I imagine there might be some American money that comes his way when he's released for that kind of thing.
Well, and this will kind of link us into, I think, the final segment that we want to kind of run through. But Steve Bannon, former chief strategist for Donald Trump, is going out of his way now to set up a European kind of project of kind of funneling cash and training and things to far-right movements in the European Union and in Europe as an attempt to kind of grow his ideology outside of the United States.
A sort of global league of anti-globalist parties, if you will.
Yes, exactly that. And, you know, UKIP and Robinson are likely to be very key players in that.
Yes, and in fact, it's come out that he's seen renowned social liberal Jacob Rees-Mogg. I believe he's also seen Nigel Farage.
And he's on very good terms with Nigel Farage because of Farage's relationship with Donald Trump. He's also seen some random backbenchers like Daniel Karaczynski, the MP for Shrewsbury in Shropshire, I think it is. And of course, he's had a meeting with, a certain one, Boris Johnson, recently.
I'm sure it's completely coincidental that after renowned alt-right figure and apologist for racism Steve Bannon met political opportunist Boris Johnson a few weeks after that, Boris Johnson wrote an article in the Daily Telegraph about the burqa, in which there was a proper amount of dog whistling going on, wasn't there? I mean, Johnson almost pivots and triangulates between saying, well, yes, the burqa should not be banned, like I believe it is in Denmark, and there've been women recently who were fined for wearing it, but then compares women who wear the burqa to bank robbers and letterboxes, breaking the first rule of telling jokes, which is that you punch up and not down.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you're a former foreign secretary or just indeed an MP of any sort, unless you're telling a joke about, you know, somebody who's more senior in politics or a member of the opposition into your party in some form, everything you do will be punching down, because no matter what your rhetoric is, you are the establishment.
Well, indeed. Well, I mean, it's one of the more insane things coming out a lot of the pro-leave MPs. I mean, people like Ian Duncan Smith, I believe, and I think Andrew Jenkins as well, and Priti Patel, who talk about the establishment.
But Ian Duncan Smith was a former leader of the Conservative Party of the United Kingdom. It doesn't get more establishment than that.
Apart from, I was going to say, Jacob Rees-Mogg. But
yeah, that's fair cop.
It's blatant dog whistling, and the result has been, I mean, partly, I think, out of mishandling from the Conservative Party, which we're not really going to go into, but Brandon Lewis has asked him to apologise without going through a proper process, and Theresa May showing the political genius only she is capable of, not really saying anything, and then saying, well, maybe he should apologise. And it has become a little bit of a proxy war in the Tory party, much more so actually than the Labour anti-Semitism row, because there are not many MPs are speaking out. I wonder why that is. It's amazing the fault lines, in that all the pro-Remain MPs are against Boris and all the pro-Leave MPs are for him. It does feel like this is a manufactured row to tip a wink to Tory members that Boris is actually more right-wing than he has come across before, especially given his policies as Mayor of London.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. Boris is the ultimate political opportunist. This is the man who was Mayor of London, one of the most liberal, diverse and multicultural cities in the world, who at the time was praising it for all of those features, who would praise freedom of religion, who would praise freedom of speech and freedom of expression, still whilst waving Union Jacks, because that's who he is, and that's what's expected of a Conservative Party politician. But he was the champion of the liberal wing of the Conservatives, the man who could deliver liberal votes in a liberal city like London. That was what was meant to make Boris Johnson an existential threat to Labour, because he could bring aspects of the left to him.
Hmm.
Compare and contrast that to the article that's been released. Compare and contrast that to the way that Boris Johnson has been acting since the Brexit referendum. It's the complete opposite. He's gone from liberal conservative to full-on right-wing conservative. With triangulation thrown in there, but all in all, he's just made a massive leap. And with very little continuity of any views put in there, he just seems to be spouting whatever it is he thinks that the audience that's most relevant to him furthering his career wants to hear.
And you do get the impression that was why he backed Brexit in the first place.
Well, we know for a fact that he wrote two letters, which were going to go to the Telegraph. One which was backing Remain, one which was backing Brexit. This is a man who has constantly weighed every decision he's ever made in politics up against his ambition to become Prime Minister. This is not a man with principles. This is just a man who's completely out for himself.
On last week's show, when we were talking about the Tory leadership nonsense going on, and you said that Boris could well become the candidate for the ERG group of the really pro-Brexit MPs, which is chaired by Rees-Mogg at the moment, essentially because he's got no principles and will deliver the Brexit they want. Yeah. Do you think this is part of that? Do you think that's more likely now?
I think that is quite possibly part of the calculation. Whether or not Boris was banking on Theresa May screwing up the handling of this, I don't know. I doubt it. But it hasn't actually hurt him, necessarily. As long as he doesn't get the whip removed from him, which is very, very unlikely, let's be honest here, this is probably doing him quite a bit of a favour. Because what's going to happen is that he's positioned himself very strongly with the right of the Tory party, which automatically gives him a base for the first round of the Conservative Party leadership contest, which before now he may not have necessarily had. Because of his backing, quote-unquote, for a hard Brexit, because of these sorts of comments and the fact that he's clearly courting that right-wing vote, he may at least have the start of enough votes to make sure he gets through to the final two in the Conservative Party leadership contest. And if he does, name recognition and star value, quote-unquote, may be enough just to get him through and make him leader, and therefore quite possibly the next Prime Minister.
Well, indeed, and the polling suggests, and part of the polling, I think, that was said that 25% of people are willing to vote for an anti-immigration, anti-Islamist party, have also found that they trusted Boris Johnson more than Theresa May to lead Brexit negotiations. So there's that calculation as well. I hope you've enjoyed that really fun summer episode of Not Enough Champagne while on holiday with that in your headphones. We'll be back next week talking about what makes a good MP.
And hopefully much less depressing fascism.
Yes. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper, and James Crown designed our logo. Our website is notenoughchampagne.com, and our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. My Twitter handle is @paperbackwriter,
and mine is @acousticradical.
Happy plotting, everyone. Count Duckula?
Count Duckula.
Or is it Count Dankula?
No, it's Count Dankula, yeah.
Not Count Dankula. No,
Count Dankula's a very good 1990s TV show, TV show.
I was thinking, actually, Count Dankula, I don't think he's of the alt-right. If anything,
probably... He's the anti-alt-right. He's a vegetarian.
I imagine Count Dankula's probably a centrist dad.
Yeah. So, or absolute worst, Milibandite Ed.
Yeah, centrist ducks.